active learning. So this is the third of Angelicious Shabbat of Learning. And that's how I feel about it. It's so richly delicious. And we'll take a few, we'll have time certainly at the close of this session also to reflect a little bit together. But without any further ado, let's jump into the third session.
Circumcision. I panicked for a second. I said, oh, circumcision is the ritual removal of the foreskin from the penis. Follow-up question? What's a foreskin? So there I am, like on a board, drawing pictures and a diagram. I thought to go the old cup technique to show. And I'm like, I'm fired. I've been working for 1 year. Because I've drawn penises on the board for 18-year-old students. So we're going to be talking about circumcision for the next 20 minutes. And people often say, oh, why do you talk so much about circumcision? I'm not the God that made it the mark of an entire people. If you have a beef with me talking too much about circumcision, there is a higher power. You can take that concern to me. We're going to be talking about circumcision for an obvious reason, which is that one of the ways Christianity very quickly distinguished itself from Jewish communities was through initiation rites, and specifically a rejection of circumcision. I'll save that for Mike. What I want to talk about is the change in Jewish views towards circumcision in the exact same period. So this is called rabbis, you could say reimagining circumcision. I made it reinforcing circumcision. Again, like Passover this morning, you might say, why do the rabbis have to reinforce or reimagine circumcision? Circumcision is circumcision. All the way back to Abraham, Jews have been circumcising their boys. So if you went back to the time of Jesus or before that, surely a male circumcision would look like it does today. What I'm going to suggest to you is that that's not actually true. The way we do circumcision today is actually different than the way it was done before the rabbis. And there's actually quite a good reason for that. So I'm going to talk for 15, 20 minutes about the ways in which the rabbis reinforce circumcision. Now it starts by talking about something that's the opposite of circumcision. You may know that starting with the rise of Hellenistic influence in Jewish communities, Michael was actually just talking about Alexander the Great, who conquered the Middle Eastern world in the 330s and 320s and brought with him Greco-Roman culture. And that meant that in the 200s and the 100s BCE, many Jews, not only in the diaspora, but also in the land of Israel, found themselves under Greek influence, learning Greek language, reading Greek books, participating in Greek-style activities, and so on and so forth. And so we read that in the middle of the 2nd century, as a part of the Hanukkah story you're all familiar with, one of the reasons why the Maccabees were so furious is that it appears that even in Jerusalem herself, in the 170s, a number of Jewish men were undergoing the procedure to have their circumcision removed. So in your first passage that is on your sheet, you can see a paragraph from the book of 1 Maccabees that talks about, from an obviously polemical perspective, some of the egregious Hellenizing mistakes that people in Jerusalem are making. So it says, in those days, renegades came out from Israel and misled many, saying, let us go and make a covenant with the Gentiles around us, for since we separated from them, many disasters have come upon us. This proposal pleased them, and some of the people eagerly went to the king, who authorized them to observe the ordinances of the Gentiles. So they built a gymnasium in Jerusalem, according to the Gentile custom, and they removed the marks of circumcision and thus abandoned the Holy Covenant. They joined with the Gentiles and sold themselves to do evil. Now, if you look much more broadly at literature from this era, you will find that it was not only the Hellenizers in Jerusalem that were participating in this activity. It seems as though there were men throughout the Greco-Roman world who were trying to reverse the marks of circumcision. Now, why would you reverse the marks of circumcision?
They wanted to be
unclean.
Part of the Greek games.
Yes, nudity was an important part of Greco-Roman culture, in the baths, in the gymnasium, and if you wanted to be a part of that culture, surely there was a measure of shame if you did not look the way the other men looked. In addition, there is plenty of evidence to suggest that Greek and Roman literature, Greek and Roman authors, found circumcision to be... I wouldn't go so far as saying an affront to humanity, but it was a way of ruining the otherwise pristine body. And so circumcision was unpopular, and you wouldn't want to be in public at a bath or a gymnasium showing off your Jewish mark, which was offensive. And by the way, Jews in many cases were identified. Their identifying characteristic was the cut Jew or the circumcised Jew. People in antiquity were given stereotypical nicknames by many Greek and Roman authors. The painted Gaul, because apparently they painted their faces, or the effete Greek, and the cut Jew. So, there is actually a wonderful text that talks about one of these poor Jewish schmoes who wanted to be a part of regular society, and so tried to cover up the marks of his circumcision. And this passage is in one of the epigrams of Martial. If you don't know Martial or know what an epigram is a short, often satirical, funny poem that makes an observation about something in the world around the epigrammatist. I don't know, sort of like stand-up comedians, maybe, in antiquity. And Martial was really one of the greatest of all these writers. Latin is a hard language to learn, and I'm not by any sense a Latinist, but to learn Martial and Catullus is a great reward for learning Latin, because if you like naughty, ribald, ancient languages, what they write about is quite intriguing. As you're going to see here in this epigram from Martial in 782, he writes, so large a fibula covers Monophilus's penis, that it would be enough by itself for all of our comic actors. It looks like Monophilus is some kind of actor or singer. I had supposed, because we often bathed together, that he was anxious to spare his voice, O Flaccus. But while he was in a game, in the middle of the sports ground with everybody watching, the fibula slipped off of the poor soul, and he was circumcised. So first, what's a fibula? Well, what's that?
Bone in the leg.
I can't hear you.
It's a bone in the leg.
It is a bone in the leg, that is true, but I don't think that he fibula depicted here. If you bad boys, you know what I'm talking about. Lightsabers are in our house, and I can't tell you what they do with them. No. I think fibula is actually a fairly specific term here, because there were many different ways that a circumcised person or a young man whose uncircumcised penis wasn't quite covered well enough. There were lots of different techniques to make it look like a nice Greek or a nice Roman penis. So one technique was something called fibulation, where apparently you would pull as much skin over the penis as you could, and then there would be like a stick, and you would stick it through, kind of like a clothespin maybe, and it would be nice and closed. Now some people went much beyond that. There was all kinds of various manipulation you could do over time, there were surgeries you could do, there were prosthetics you could wear, but fibulation was a very popular technique, and it was a technique that was apparently used a lot by singers, because the belief was that if you are fibulated, somehow your voice is protected. I don't think that's the case, but that was an assumption. So this poor guy, the author Marshall, he assumes, oh, he was wearing this fibula in order to protect his voice. Until I found out, when I saw him wrestling or playing racquetball or whatever, and it fell off, and lo and behold, he was actually wearing it to hide his circumcision. And that, of course, is a shame, right? A mark of shame that he... It is a shanda. A shanda for the going, I guess. Yeah. This phenomenon of trying to reverse the circumcision went on. It probably began in the 3rd and 2nd centuries BCE. It continued in the 1st century BCE, in the 1st century CE, in the 2nd century CE. Though it's interesting to note that starting in the 3rd and 4th century and beyond, there was almost no discussion of reversing circumcisions in Jewish texts, of reversing circumcisions or dealing with the reversal of circumcision, frankly, all the way up until the Enlightenment, when, especially in liberal quarters in Europe, people begin to question the barbarity of circumcision and whether or not it's necessary. Specifically, that conversation was had in the early reform movement in Germany. So what do the rabbis do? Dealing with a culture in which apparently a significant enough number of men were engaging in this kind of procedure of returning the foreskin over the penis, which has a special Greek name. It's called epispasm. It makes sense in Greek, but it's called epispasm. That is the procedure for bringing the foreskin back. Well, we know that this procedure was going on well into the 2nd century, because in an ancient rabbinic text, something called the Tosefta, which is like the Mishnah, the rabbis suggest that actually one of the great problems of epispasm occurred during the Bar Kokhba revolt, which was the second great revolt against Rome in 132 CE. And they say, dealing with a law that says, look, if someone pulls their foreskin back, you have to recircumcise them. But there's a problem with that, and that's what this Tosefta is about. So the Tosefta says, one who has drawn his foreskin forward must be circumcised. But Rabbi Judah says, one who has drawn forward his foreskin need not be circumcised because it is dangerous. The rabbi said, no. Many men were circumcised in the days of Bar Kokhba, and they went on to have children and did not die. So the rabbis seem to think, no, during the Bar Kokhba revolt, when Bar Kokhba and his army were quite conservative in their approach to Jewish identity, apparently there were lots of men who had undergone epispasm, and Bar Kokhba said, in order to be a part of our movement, you need to be circumcised. And in the rabbi's memory, they all did fine. Therefore, there's no problem in demanding that men who have had epispasm reverse that epispasm through circumcision. But the rabbis then went one step further. And they said, you know what we're going to do? We are going to make it impossible for Jewish boys to grow up and get epispasm. Well, how do you do that? You go the extra mile when performing the circumcision. So what you see in the next two texts are from the Mishnah, describing circumcision. And it says, one performs all the requirements of circumcision even on Shabbat. You know that. A baby's born on Saturday, the bris is the next Saturday. One may circumcise, perform perea, suck the wound, and apply a bandage with cumin to the wound. Now, the only thing I'm concerned about here is perea. Sucking is meant to get the blood out, and then cumin is meant to help clot. But what is perea? Well, for those of you who are not mohalim and have not been, like, staring, you know, at the front of the table during a bris, circumcision just refers to cutting the foreskin. That's the way it was done before the rabbis. The rabbis are here inserting another ritual into the procedure, where you cut away the membrane as best you can around the glands of the penis so that no form of the foreskin can redevelop, creating a problem. And so you see that represented in this next mission. These are the remnants of flesh that invalidate a circumcision. So what if a boy gets circumcised, but then the flesh grows back to cover the majority of the glands? Or a portly fellow, he should also fix his circumcision for the sake of appearances. And then they say this great line, if a man were circumcised, but perea was not performed. In other words, if you circumcise a boy the way Jews were circumcised for 1,000 years, it is as though he is not circumcised. You must perform the act of perea in order to make the epispasm, the return of the foreskin, impossible. So in that sense, what the rabbis are doing is reinforcing the physical act of circumcision by saying, we are going to make it so clear that it cannot be reversed. I want to take just 3 more minutes and try to show you one step even further beyond that, that the rabbis went to make sure that you Jews know that circumcision is incredibly important. So on one level, they say, we are going to make it physically irreversible. Then they go beyond and say, we are going to make it ontologically, in the sense of human existence, we are going to make it ontologically the definitive marker of the Jew. So that every Jew, simply by dint of being Jewish, is circumcised. And any circumcised person is not necessarily a Jew. In other words, even a Gentile who is circumcised is not really circumcised. Now, how are they going to do that? Well, they do it in a fascinating passage from the Talmud, which is at the end of your page, in which their basic question is, and we're going to do a little group activity here. Their basic question is, don't worry. Actually, you do have silverware. The plastic's not going to work. The question in the Talmud is, why can a Gentile not be a Moyle? I'm sure you have many Moyles in Westchester County, right? There are probably female Moyles in Westchester County, we'll talk about that, but there's no Chris Christensen who's a Moyle. Because unless he's converted. But you have to be a Jew to be a Moyle. So now the rabbis are, okay, well, why? Now, what's the verse that determines that? And they draw on one verse that says, this verse would suggest that a Moyel must be a Jewish man. It's a verse related to Abraham. Abraham's a Jewish man. So they say, okay, if you're on this room, this side of the room, you are the people who argue that a Moyel must be a Jewish man. A Moyel must be a Jew. Let me leave it at that. Okay? A Moyel must be... Let's go with Jewish man. A Moyel must be a Jewish man. Got it? So, why can't a Gentile circumcise? He's not a Jewish man. This side of the room is going to go with the other solution. The other solution is, in order to be a Moyel, you must be circumcised. That's your argument. Okay. Now, at first the rabbis say, well, wait a minute. You don't need 2 different explanations, because those are the same thing. So, a circumcised person is a Jewish man, and a Jewish man is circumcised. But that's not how the Talmud works. The Talmud says, this great sage would not have come up with this idea, and this sage with this idea, unless they were 2 different things. So, what's the difference? So they have to come up with the case where you and you would disagree. So what's the case? Well, the first rabbi steps forward and says, ah, the difference would be a circumcised Egyptian. Or a boy in 1975 who was born in America and circumcised because that's just what they do. Right? In that case, you would say he can circumcise because he's circumcised. But you would say he can't because he's not a Jewish man. The rabbis discuss and discuss and discuss, and eventually they say, nope. He actually doesn't qualify in either. Why? The first line you have here in Aramaic. Ach al gav de mehile, kaman de la mehile dama. Even though this circumcised Gentile is circumcised, it's as if he's not circumcised. So then they say, ah, what's another example that might be different? And someone steps forward and says, well, what about a hemophiliac Jewish boy? Because you may know that if you're born as a boy and you've had a couple of older brothers who have died during circumcision, you are not circumcised. And you, because you're going to die. And so you grow up and you are a foreskinned Jewish man. In which case, you would say he can circumcise because he's a Jewish man. But you would say he can't circumcise because he's not circumcised. The rabbis argue and argue and argue, and eventually they conclude, even though he isn't circumcised, he's circumcised. Well, that's lovely. It's completely punitive. It doesn't make any sense, but it's a lovely sentiment. So you say, well, what the heck is the difference? And someone comes along and says, ah, a Jewish woman. Because a Jewish woman, according to you, could she circumcise? No, she's not a Jewish man. But according to you, could she circumcise? Yes, because she's circumcised. What? The last one says, Isha keman de mehila danya. A Jewish woman, simply by dint of being a Jewish woman, is considered as though she has a circumcised penis. And therefore, according to this teaching, could qualify as a moel. Or in this case, a mohelet. So that is some very convoluted thinking that really, no pun intended, stretches reality beyond where one really ought to. Yes. But this is all the same passage. And it concludes with this, and then it goes on to say, well, wait, can't a woman can circumcise? We already knew that because you may know that Moses' mother circumcises him. They say, oh, Moses' mother didn't circumcise him, the other side. They say, oh, no, the verb there is he feel because the woman gave the flint to a man who then circumcised. It's a long story. But the upshot of all of this is that not only do the rabbis ratchet up circumcision physically by saying you must make circumcision irreversible, they ratchet it up even further by saying that circumcision is so closely identified with the Jewish people that every Jew, whether he's a hemophiliac boy or a woman, is circumcised. And any other person, even if he is circumcised, ain't really circumcised. And that's the way they reimagine, reinforce circumcision to make it far more intense a marker of Jewish identity than it had ever been before. Thank you. And now we'll get to hear how circumcision is. No point.
Sorry, I took a few
moments.
I don't like to, but I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know how to follow that. I'm having flashbacks to when I was doing a graduate school research paper on Jewish identity in the Hellenistic world, and I Googled uncircumcised penis just for some research. I don't recommend it. A lot of my computer had a lot of pop-up windows. A lot of things were happening. I regret the decision. So learn from my mistake. So. With a bunch of, yeah, I have a long handout here. It's like a party favor. You can take it home and enjoy it. I couldn't decide how much I wanted to include. Just a whole packet. Before we get to the texts on my handout, I want to give. Is this table? Yeah, okay, you're good. I want to give you a very basic summary of an important part of early Christianity, what I in my classes would call Gentile expansion or Gentile inclusion. And so here's how I want to do this quick summary. When I teach Introduction to the New Testament, Introduction to the Christian Scriptures, on the first day I say there are two core questions that are the driving energy of these early Christian writings. One of them, we already discussed a bit this morning, which is, why did the Messiah die, in Christian understanding, and what does it mean? But a second question is related more to this topic, which is the question of Gentile inclusion, and that is, maybe we could think of it as, if Gentiles are now to be included in the covenant with the one true God, the God of Israel, how? So I think these are the two core questions that are giving energy to these early Christian writings, early Christian theology. So this second one, which I'll call Gentile inclusion, is usually associated with a man named Paul. Who is Paul? Paul was someone who never knew Jesus in the flesh. Paul did not follow Jesus around and hear his parables and watch his working of wonders and watch him dine with the outcasts. He didn't do any of that. Paul was someone who had a vision after Jesus' death. And in Christian understanding, after Jesus' resurrection, Paul had a vision where he believed Jesus was talking to him, a religious experience that called him to a reorientation of his life. And in Western religious history, it's often thought about as an archetype of conversion, like a primal conversion experience. Now, Paul's conversion or Paul's reorientation, I would say, was not primarily one from being Jewish to being Christian, because Paul, I think, lived and died thinking of himself as a Jew. I think his primary reorientation of his life was believing that God was calling him to spread covenant with the God of Israel to the Gentiles. And he believed, I think, that Isaiah had prophesied to him, that Paul was fulfilling some of Isaiah's prophecies to spread the God of Israel to the Gentiles. Now, let's say you're in one of these cities. You're in Rome or Corinth or Ephesus, and you meet Paul and you listen to him, and he's explaining the God of Israel, he's explaining the wonders of the ancestors and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and teaching you about these beautiful customs and these traditions, and you're feeling drawn up into this idea, and he tells you that this God had an anointed one who healed people and reached out to the sick in Galilee, and it was very sad that he was crucified, but he rose from the dead, and he still prayed to him. Okay, so that's Christianity, right? So Paul gives this basic message, and then Paul says, what if Paul were to say, and so in order to join this group, we're going to have to cut off part of your penis. This man, that's a hard sell. This is a barrier to evangelism. This is a barrier to a lot of people's listening, especially as Josh said, in a Greco-Roman worldview that almost deifies the nude male form. And this is a very difficult matter. Now, the way I just summarize it is not what Paul says in his writings. I'm trying to give you just a sense, kind of behind the text, of what these encounters might have been like. So through Paul's life and his prayer and his belief that he's receiving revelations from God, he comes to believe that in this age where Paul believes the Messiah has come and been resurrected, that some of the commandments of the God of Israel do not apply to Gentiles. and that they in fact can be in covenant with the God of Israel through the Messiah, through Jesus as the Messiah, can be in covenant with the God of Israel without doing all of the commandments of the Torah, all the mitzvot. So, yeah, that's a summary. That's the briefest summaries I can give, I think, of this part of early Christian history, of this part of the New Testament. Paul has opponents, then, who say no. Opponents who are people who believe in Jesus and follow Jesus, who are Jews, who say, no, Paul, that's not actually our message. We have a different message, and we don't know what you're saying over there in Rome, and we don't know what you're saying over there in Ephesus. Why don't you come to Jerusalem and talk to us a little bit more, and let's all get on the same page. So they do that, but Paul still has this kind of blessing to be an apostle to the Gentiles, as he's called, or one who sends out his message to the Gentiles. So of all of this attempt at including Gentiles in the covenant with the God of Israel, the most challenging, controversial aspect was circumcision. It was more controversial or challenging than Sabbath observance or keeping kosher or anything like that. So I've given some texts that refer to this challenging experience for Paul and for early Christians. What Paul says here in the first text, again writing to a community of early Christians in Greece, he's talking about people who are born slaves and should they seek their freedom, and people who are unmarried and should they get married, and people who are married, should they have children. He's responding to questions that these early Christians have, who they think, how different are our lives supposed to be now? Now that we have converted, how different are we supposed to be? Within that chapter, where he's giving his thoughts, he says this: let each of you lead the life that the Lord has assigned to which God called you. This is my rule in all the churches. Was anyone at the time of his call, meaning his call to enter this community, was anyone already circumcised? Let him not seek to remove the marks of circumcision. The Greek there is this verb, epispado, epispasm, that Josh was referring to. Let him not seek to remove those marks of circumcision. Was anyone at the time of his call uncircumcised? Let him not seek circumcision. Circumcision is nothing, uncircumcision is nothing. But obeying the commandments of God is everything. Let each of you remain in the condition in which you were called. So for Paul, who's trying to create a mixed community of Jews and Gentiles, his compromise view is saying, whatever way you were when you joined this community, stay that way. Don't seek circumcision or don't seek to remove it. But what he's also done in this phrase is really contradicted a central part of Torah when he's saying, don't seek this out. And then he says, obeying the commandments of God is what counts. But of course, in the Torah, this isn't one of the commandments of God. So there's a contradiction there, or a paradox, that Paul's opponents push against him about. I think one way to understand Paul on this is that fundamentally, we have to remember that Paul believed the world was about to end. Paul believed that he was living in the Messianic age, that everything was different now. And so whether or not one gets circumcised or doesn't, or whether one has children or not, whether one, whatever one is doing, it's all in the process of turning of the age to the age of the Messiah. So there's a kind of apocalyptic fervor still there. In the second text, now we see the way in which he's expressing how he's trying to end some of these barriers between Jews and Gentiles. No longer Jew or Greek, no longer slave or free, no longer male and female, for all of you are one in Christ Jesus. If you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise. What Paul's doing in this text, a different one of his letters, is he's trying to make an argument that Gentiles are inheritors of the promises to Abraham. And what Paul has to do in that is then explain why these Gentiles don't have to be circumcised. It's a difficult argument for him to make. And if I can't summarize it all here, it's even complicated for those of us who read Greek and study these texts. But Paul's ultimate conclusion he's trying to argue for is that Gentiles can inherit the promise to Abraham and claim to be Abraham's offspring, but they do not have to follow all of the law of Moses. They do not have to follow all of the Torah. The reason I put the third excerpt here is then to note how authors in the New Testament and the Christian scriptures, how they start to interpret circumcision metaphorically. And Josh already gave a bit of this already within Judaism is happening as well. Circumcision of the heart is right there in Deuteronomy. This is not only an early Christian idea. But in this line, in a different letter, at the beginning there, it says, in Jesus, you were circumcised with a spiritual circumcision by putting off the body of the flesh in the circumcision of Christ. So this idea of stripping off part of the body, physically in circumcision, is interpreted metaphorically here as kind of stripping off of fleshly desires, of fleshly life, of material desires. So it's a kind of ethical argument, but it's also connected to the death of Christ, the death of his body, and the blood that is involved there. I want to get to some other things, so I'm going to move more quickly now. I pulled, of the many texts I could have pulled from the 3rd and 4th century of early Christians, this one seemed to have the most to it. Aphrahat was an early Christian writing in Syriac, as I say there, in 3rd and 4th century. And he makes a connection here where he says, between Yeshua, Joshua, Jesus, and Joshua, son of Nun. And in the course of making these connections, he says, Joshua, or Jesus, our Redeemer, a second time circumcised the peoples who believed in him with circumcision of the heart. And they were baptized and circumcised with the knife. And then you can imagine he's thinking of another text. How do I make the knife make symbolic sense? The knife, which is his word that is sharper than a two-edged sword. And I've given you here that he's quoting a different early Christian text. So the idea that God's word through Jesus is sharper than a two-edged sword, for Aphrahat said, that's the knife. That's the knife of spiritual circumcision. It's the word of God that circumcises the heart. Joshua, son of Nun, led the people across to the land of promise, promised land. And Joshua, Jesus, our Redeemer, promised the land of the living to whoever passed through the true Jordan. So now we have a second symbolic connection of the crossing of the Jordan for the Israelites is like the water of baptism in early Christian understanding. So there's a circumcision and there's a crossing of the Jordan into the land of promise, right? That promise that Paul has already said, he is trying to argue that Gentiles can also inherit. Blessed are those whose hearts are circumcised from the foreskin and who are born through water, the second circumcision, for they are inheritors with Abraham. It is not obvious, in terms of the ritual, how in the world going under water to be cleansed is like circumcision. I agree with you. That is not, I've read these texts many times, there's nothing obvious about it. So the authors are working pretty hard to make this work. Now the passing through the Jordan part, well that makes sense. We went through some water and came out the other side, and we were saved and free and in the land of promise. And so that baptismal analogy works, but the circumcision of baptism one is quite difficult, and yet they do it over and over and over again, and I think the connection is how does one belong to a community? What is the sign of their belonging? That's why we titled this session about rituals and rites of communal belonging. I don't know if there are any baptism experts in here, or what Christians do in baptism, but I thought I would give you just a basic, I wrote out some of the basic ideas of what early Christian baptism then is. We don't know very much about the first couple centuries. We have very limited evidence. There seems to have been a preference for outdoor spaces, for running water, something similar to the Jordan. to connect to that original origin, the origin of baptism. But by the 3rd century at least, more and more Christians are being initiated indoors with much more ornate rituals, or even sets of rituals. And then and around this time, there's much more baptism of children and infants as well. And that is starting to become a major part of the ritual experience. When more and more infants start to be baptized, the connection to circumcision gets stronger. Because then you have it as a rite of welcoming an infant into a community. And there are even some texts, I didn't give them here, but some texts which talk about that if someone is not baptized by the 8th day, then there's a problem. So there are clearly, and it's an obvious, I should have put that on it, but there are some obvious connections in the 4th and 5th century that early Christians are making between infant baptism and infant circumcision. But as to the meanings of these early Christian initiations, there is literally no consensus. This is the subject of a lot of my research. I teach graduate seminars on this. My second book that I wrote was basically about these materials. And in all of my reading and study from Eastern Syria all the way to modern-day France and North Africa, this large period of early Christianity, on your next page I've given you a list on the left of the rituals that can comprise early Christian initiation. And the asterisk is very important. Not all rituals were used in all times and all places. But this is a list in rough order of the rituals in which they might be done. So including sort of teaching beforehand, fasting beforehand, disrobing of clothes, an exorcism of demons, renouncing the devil, professing what one believes in, the sparking of a flame or a torch, the blessing of water, the use of the water, either going into it as immersion or it being poured over someone, as what we call effusion, anointing with oil, putting on new clothing, eating milk or drinking milk and honey, obvious connection to the promised land there, but also something that makes one think of an infant. We don't give infants honey nowadays, but for them, they thought of this as something for infants. A meal, a sign of the cross, breathing on a candidate to say that they have a new spirit, and kissing. All of these rituals could be a part of an early Christian initiation. And they also don't agree universally on what all these mean. That's the way ritual works, isn't it? And so on the right side column, I've given you a whole list of possible meanings of all this ritual experience together. One of the just to pull out one of those terms that most connects to circumcision, if you look maybe two-thirds of the way down on the right side column, one of them says sealing or branding. And there's a linguistic connection here where Josh used the word mark, a mark of Jewish identity. In Eastern Christianity, especially in Syria, the word for being initiated as a Christian, they use the word rushma, and this word for mark could be a seal, like you put a seal or stamp on something. It could be a brand, like you put a brand on an animal to mark it. And it also was connected to the mark of circumcision. So there are some of these linguistic connections that are very strong. And it's not a surprise that Aphrahat, who I quoted on the previous page, was from that Syrian context with a linguistic connection. So what am I doing so far? Establishing the problem of Gentile inclusion for Paul and other early Christians, the ways in which they thought about new rituals as being like circumcision or replacing circumcision as a ritual. And what I want to conclude with is on the next page, how did my book title get on there? Makes a great, it's a great gift for Fordham right there. Just kidding. So I thought I would conclude with a brief case study, which is that the most significant site of early Christian initiation, or a place where we know it happened, was a place discovered in eastern Syria, early 3rd century city and building, in a city that's a mouthful, Dura Urobos, goes by two ancient names. This is a city on the Euphrates River in modern and ancient eastern Syria. This is the subject of my second book, and a book that intertwines early Christian theology and art history, and a study of early Christian ritual. And I just wanted to give you a sense of the place as best I could with a handout. So someday I can come back and give you 200 images and we can just relish with them for a while. If you've heard of the word Dura Urobos, you might have heard of it because one of the most impressive ancient synagogues was also discovered in the very same place, on the very same street. So it's the synagogue down the street from this early Christian house church in 3rd century Syria. So what can we learn from the art preserved on the walls of this site of early Christian initiation? What can we learn from the architecture? I've given you the bird's eye view floor plan there, and where you can see a courtyard, an assembly hall, and in the upper right, what says baptistry, and there's an arrow. So the baptistry is the room, a room of initiation, that in which the most of the art was preserved that we have. And you can see a canopied font there. So this is a photograph during the excavation, where you can see that the font, you can't really see, but I'll just tell you, it's not that deep, and so for an adult, it seems unlikely that an adult could fully immerse in this. It's more likely that there was a curtain around the canopy, and that an adult would disrobe and be nude and have water and anointing oil poured over them. It seems like a child could immerse, but it doesn't seem like an adult could immerse in this. Above that canopy font, the image was of a shepherd and a flock of sheep. I gave you the line drawing and not the photo because the photo is too hard to see on a photocopy. But there's a shepherd with sheep over his shoulders and a flock, and then a small inset of Adam and Eve. So there we have imagery of a shepherd caring for a flock. We have an image of incorporation into a community, and it looks like that flock. If you look carefully, like some of them are kind of leaning over and drinking or eating, which to my mind makes me think of "The Lord is my shepherd," the psalm. We have lying down in green pastures, right, leading beside still waters, restoring the soul. And we know that early Christians were using that psalm as a part of their initiatory rites. So I like to think of that initiate looking up and seeing this image and identifying with the flock, thinking that one is being incorporated into a new community through this ritual. The Adam and Eve inset is then likely a recalling of sinfulness and a hope for salvation from that sinfulness, and perhaps even a thinking about a new creation or a new paradise. A new world in which this person who is nude and in a sense being reborn is being reborn into their original created state of blessedness. Finally, on the last page, I've given you a look at the rest of the walls of this room. So you go to turn it sideways, or if it's not already there, turn it sideways, and I have a chapter on each of these, so I can talk at length, but very briefly, we have some miracles of Jesus where he performs where he walks on the water of the Sea of Galilee and where he heals a paralyzed man that are up on one part of the wall of what's preserved. We have a woman who's drawing water from a well, which could be any number of biblical women. We have an image of David and Goliath that we know for sure because the artist has labeled them with their names, David and Goliath, with an inscription of the donor over that. Some things never change, right? inscription of the donor. And then we have a procession of women around the southern and eastern walls of the room. There are five pairs of feet on the wall, and then a door, and then more bodies of women approaching a white something. And that one is either a procession of women to a tomb or a procession of women to a wedding. And there are art historians disagree. I'm on the wedding team, but disagree about that. So in this room we have, if we're trying to imagine, right, and there's no teacher's edition of this, right? There's not, the building's just discovered, and we have to figure out what it means. And only one of the texts is, only one image is labeled. The rest are just there. What we're seeing here, if we look at the list of what did initiation mean, we're seeing a scene of either participation in something like a marriage covenant, or something like a participation in the death and resurrection of Jesus, if it's a wedding or if it's a tomb. We're seeing a belief in miracles that Jesus performed that relate to water, which would make sense in a room for baptism. We're seeing a woman drawing water from a well, which could connect either to marriage, right? What happens when a woman goes to a well in Hebrew scriptures, right? Meet your husband, right? That could be a marriage image. It could also be other women from the New Testament. We'll get into that right now. And then this David and Goliath image is pretty shocking, and I'll conclude with this one because it's such a classic Jewish story, and it's given this whole wall right under a niche. You can see there's a niche on that wall that perhaps had oil for anointing. David, the anointed one. David, for Christians, the forerunner of Jesus as an anointed one. But in the synagogue down the street in Dura Europos, they have an image of David being anointed. But here we have an image of David and Goliath in this very, very militaristic scene about to behead him. And it seems to me that this could have some allegorical meaning about the defeat of sin, about the power over sin, the empowerment that comes with initiation. I also think it might be related to the actual military presence in this place. It's not known how Christians came to this far eastern place in Syria, but the names on the walls are names like Proclus, right? The one who paid for this to be done. The name Proclus is all over the military records of this Roman garrison in this town. So there's a possibility that they're thinking of themselves on the borderlands with Persia, on the borderlands, fighting a Goliath across the river, and they want to be empowered by their faith. They want to be empowered like David. They want to be empowered to conquer their inner demons, their inner battles, but also they feel like they're living on the edge of these empires between Syria and Persia. So now you don't need to buy the book, because I just summarized it for you. But it's a tantalizing building because we know so little about this community. We know so little about Judaism or Christianity in this place in 3rd century Syria, but we have these records on the walls that, at least to me, inspire me to continue to imagine and reimagine how these people thought about initiation and what they thought it meant to join the community and what benefits spiritually they thought they were getting from joining these communities. So we traveled far there from circumcision to this 3rd century building, but plenty to talk about, and we're happy for your questions.
I'm an art historian, so you have to go to Yale Art Museum because they have bits and pieces of Dura Europa, which is just amazing. Yeah, you know, I studied there for a while. Anyway, so go there. It's
Yale University Art Gallery.
Probably you know that place. So as you were speaking, we were talking about rituals and circumcision and water. I kept thinking about mikvah.
Yes.
Because mikvah is part and parcel of the Jewish experience, and I would imagine that everybody knew about that ritual. So, could you say that baptism is an extension of, or a memory of, that kind of rebirth through mikvah?
Mm-hmm. I've absolutely been a lot of reflection on this, and you're right. So I think in some ways, it's a yes and a no, I think. In some ways, yes, in the sense of, as you say, rebirth upon entering into something new, especially before marriage, I think. It would make a lot of sense to connect to early Christian initiation. They talk about initiation as a kind of marriage covenant frequently in these texts. And so I think that they talk about the bathing before marriage, they talk about the anointing with oil and perfume and getting new clothes. So they make all of those connections for sure. So I think that one is very strong. The other uses of ritual bathing in early Judaism, I'm not as sure about, because for early Christians, it's such a one-time event. It's this one-time life reorientation idea that is enacted through the composite rituals of baptism and anointing and the meal and everything else. And I don't know if I'm right or wrong about this. Are there other one-time mikvah experiences besides
before marriage? That's outside the other part. Before marriage.
And
conversion. I'll say a word about that.
Okay. So that would be, like I said, kind of the yes and the no. Because John the Baptist, the ritual he innovated at the Jordan River was not like that. It was not a mikvah. I mean, I like to think of what John the Baptist innovated as a pilgrimage. He was creating a pilgrimage experience for people where they were going somewhere pretty far to go on foot, and hearing a set of teachings and confessing their sins and getting dunked by this charismatic wild man into a river. So almost like a spiritual retreat. I mean, if I can take a modern analogy, that doesn't feel to me like how mikvah were used. Apart from the obvious connection to water. But like I said, some other ones do make sense to me, especially the marriage. What do you think?
Yeah.
Josh knows more than me about this. I don't know about that.
You are Goliath.
All right.
So, I agree with Michael that mikvah, as it was primarily used up until the rabbinic time, it was not used in order to mark a transition in a person's life. It was used in order to deal with the problem of ritual impurity. Right? The Jews had a temple, just like any temple in the world. If you wanted to go there and present yourself before God and sacrifice, you needed to be in a ritually pure condition. And according to the Torah, there are all kinds of things that make you ritually impure. Menstruation and other genital fluxes, both male and female, and dead bodies, and skin diseases. All of these things would make a person unfit to go to the temple. And so having a mikvah, where you could then be restored, was an important thing. But what Michael's saying, I think, is right, that what John the Baptist introduces, and then what Christians have as the rite of initiation, is a one-time ontological life transformational dip that turns you into a new person. And the only analog I think we have is the dip that occurs at conversion. Snip and dip for men, just dip for women. And I actually wrote an article, which I don't think anyone read, and maybe for good reason, tucked away in a little edited volume somewhere. I made an argument that I actually think has some merit. Where I suggested that the baptism that we use at conversion may well have been drawn from the Christian idea of conversionary baptism. And my argument was that before the first century CE, there was no such thing as conversion to Judaism for women. Why? Because when conversion to Judaism started in the 3rd century or the 2nd century, keep in mind, you're thinking in ancient racial or ethnic terms, but you have to fundamentally transform yourself in order to become a Jew. Now, for men, there was a ritual. Right? There was known as far back as David, and David was chopping foreskins right and left, according to the Bible, right? That's how you brought a person in. I don't know if you know that story. But for men, there was an obvious ritual. You want to become a part of the Jewish people, you get circumcised. But there are many stories of women in the 1st century BC and the 1st century CE who were very interested in joining the Jewish community. And as far as I can tell from the sources, there's no evidence to suggest that they were understood as proselytes, proselutoi, proselytai in that case. And so my argument was that this became a problem for Paul. Because Paul, as I understand Paul, was trying to make people new Jews. And yet a huge number of his followers were women. And I think it is him who said, wait a minute, the best way to figure out how to get around this problem of not being able to convert women is to make baptism the equivalent of circumcision. And it's my argument that that's the way the rabbis eventually conceptualized how you can make a woman a Jew. That in fact, baptism in a mikvah is the true conversionary experience. Therefore, women are baptized to become Jew, and men are cut and then baptized in order to become Jew. So if that's the case, this would be one where conversionary entrance to the community through baptism actually begins in Christianity and migrates over to the rabbis.
Oh, interesting.
Yes.
Yes.
Jesus lived and died as a Jew. Paul, from what I understand from today's talks, saw himself as a Jew and was bringing people into Reform Judaism, if you will. By the 3rd century in Duro Europa, there's a Christian house of worship. So my question is, when did Christianity become Christianity? When did someone, some board sitting around the table say, you know, we're not going to pay dues to the URJ anymore. We're Christians. When did that happen?
You're going to get a different answer. We'll give two answers. I bet we'll say something different. I don't know. Well, I'll go first.
I'm just still dealing with the URJ.
Yeah.
The same thing. I'll talk.
So the first answer I would say is that the answer in different regions, the pace of change was different. So one of the ways that historians now talk about this is we, when someone asks me that question, I say where. And I don't give a date, say the year 100 or the year 200 or the year whatever, because there are times, or at least sorry, there are places around the ancient Mediterranean where it looks like the split is happening pretty strongly by the early 2nd century, let's say. But then there is all of this countervailing evidence in some other places. The most prominent example of this would be in the 380s in Antioch of Syria. A Christian bishop of Antioch named John Chrysostom, John Goldenmouth, he's a great preacher, also very long-winded. But John Chrysostom has to preach a series of sermons to try to get Christians to stop going to synagogue on high holidays. Hmm. Now, of course, we debate to what to, you know, it's hard to, this is the only examples we have of this from this period, but he seems pretty bothered, he seems pretty upset about it, that there are people who feel comfortable kind of going back and forth. So there are, again, the question would be where, you know, exactly where. I don't see it in the first century. I don't see a strong split. I think most of the split is happening throughout the course of the second century. When we were here 12 or whatever years ago, this is one of the topics that we talked about, was looking at second century texts on the Christian side and second century texts on the Jewish side, which are trying to firm up the boundaries. You know, one thing leaders really like is to know who they're leading. They want to know who's in their group. And so leaders get frustrated when there's fuzziness on the borders of their groups. And so you've got, you know, Jews in the Tosefta and the Mishnah taking some strong stances about who's in and who's out. And, oh, you got healed by someone in the name of Jesus? You should have died. It'd be better if you're dead. Someone healed you in the name of Jesus. I mean, these texts are in the Tosefta. And on the Christian side, you have people saying, you know, that you cannot hang out with anyone who's circumcised, and you need to avoid any involvement with Judaism. So what that tells us as historians is that there was fuzziness, there was involvement, and that many leaders are trying to firm up those boundaries. I feel like you had another part to your question that I've now blanked on.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'll say three things. Two are very quick. One, please remember that one of the missions of the URJ is to support the Union College, which gives us amazing rabbis to lead our congregation. Second of all, on the issue of Paul as a Reformed Jew, I would note that I actually gave a paper at a conference that Michael got me invited to, in which I argued that the antinomian language, the against the law language of Paul, and the antinomian language of the radical German reformers, specifically my hero Samuel Holtheim in the 1840s and 50s, are identical. And that one of the reasons I, as a somewhat radical Reformed Jew, and so obsessed with Paul, is that I see a lot of the Reformed Jewish experience in the difficult circumstances of Paul, which is to say, just as Paul believed that Jesus had risen from the dead and felt that he couldn't unknow that and he had to re-understand Judaism in light of that experience, so 19th century European Jews tasted enlightenment and emancipation and said, we can't understand what Judaism means unless we incorporate that experience. And now I'm writing a book about that. But that's a ways off. Third thing, I agree with Michael 100% about the complexity of the parting of the ways. But maybe another way to look at it is to take all the complexity out and answer it this way. Either Judaism and Christianity became parted the moment Mary or Peter or whoever said, he's risen. Because believing in a resurrected Jesus can't be Judaism. That's one way of thinking about it. Or you could say on the way other end, they never parted. Judaism and Christianity are still two different versions of the same thing. In the way, I don't believe that either. Nor do I believe that they became distinct the very moment the first Christian belief happened. But it's a different way of thinking about the problem. In one way I sometimes teach this is to talk about alligators and crocodiles. That when we see Christianity, we see this big, menacing crocodile that's going to eat us and has sharp teeth. But maybe if we start to understand ourselves as alligators, like, oh, well, compared to an ostrich or an emu or a walrus, this crocodile is a lot more like me than I thought. And one of the advantages of this kind of studying and studying with other people is that you start to get a little bit more of a bird's eye view and you see, wow, these two groups are a lot more similar than we ever thought. Different way of thinking about the question.
I have one more. Paraphrasing a scholar of this named Daniel Boyarin, but it's been influential on me. He makes comparison between religion and language. Linguistics, and there's a paragraph in one of his books where he says, you know, if you're in Paris, you know you're speaking French. In the morning you say bonjour, right? You walk around. And if you get on a plane and fly to Florence, you know you're speaking Italian. And you say buongiorno, right, in the morning. But if you walk from Paris to Florence, you don't get on a plane, you walk. And you spend a couple days in each village, and you walk across the Alps, and all this.
And there are no signs.
And there, that's right. There are no signs, right? No border, right? You know, the border. He's like, when do you stop saying bonjour and start saying buongiorno? Right. There's no point. Right. There's no exact moment where that happens. Like, the language is slightly changing, and the food is slightly changing, the culture is slightly changing as you go. And that image really helped me to think about this, because it retains both things. It says there are differences, right, in certain ways, but there's also this fuzziness that we can never fully articulate.
Okay, last question.
Very nice.
Struck me in reading the first two sources that were brought up, that I wondered whether or not the difference in the attitudes about circumcision informed or influenced in some way the modern reluctance of Jewish people to proselytize, whereas the Paul thing quoted seemed more like something that, the way my friends would have put it, who went to Catholic school in the 1950s, if you have something good, wouldn't you want everyone to have it? And it seemed to me, and I didn't know whether or not that was a conscious thing or, you know, just happenstance.
I think I understand your question. I don't think we can overestimate the degree to which Paul thought there was good news to share. Paul believed that a human being had been resurrected from the dead. Paul, as a Jew, believed that if a human being had been resurrected from the dead, then the final age had started. The final eschatological end of time resurrection of the dead was happening. Paul wanted to tell everybody. And Paul came to believe, I think, that unless the Gentiles knew about the God of Israel, then the final turn of the age to the age of the Messiah wouldn't come about. So he was trying to fulfill Jewish prophecy and Jewish beliefs in the way that he understood them by spreading this good news to the Gentiles. Now, as we know, looking back, it didn't happen. The Messianic age didn't happen in the way that Paul thought it would, or that anybody thought it would. But I think that was Paul's vision of that moment.
So I guess I would say, I hear people often talk about how, you know, Jews are not proselytizing and Christians are. And I often caution people not to overlook a certain impulse within Judaism going back thousands of years that is evangelistic. The great Maccabean king, John Hyrcanus, was conquering the provinces around Judea and circumcising the peoples that he found there. And we've talked about David in the past, and so on and so forth. And keep in mind, still today, thanks to the great Rabbi Alexander Schindler, who said, we should be advertising this amazing thing, Judaism, and bringing in as many people as we can. There's always been that urge, but two things have made that urge difficult. One is that Jews have always understood themselves as something more or something different from a religion, something that is physical and ethnic, and conversion to such a thing is very difficult. Another thing to keep in mind is that even if Jews had wanted to be evangelical between the years 400 and 1985, it wasn't possible. You couldn't advertise Judaism living under crescent and cross. That would be fatal. But keep in mind, this is one of my favorite passages in all of medieval Jewish literature, that someone like Maimonides, who was never interested in converting anybody except maybe to philosophy, he makes the point in the Mishneh Torah, a fascinating point, where he argues, yeah, Jews don't convert other people. Why? Because Christians and Muslims are doing that for us. Christians are out there selling the Bible. Muslims are out there selling monotheism. So that one day when Messiah comes back, most people in the world are almost there already. Look it up.
more questions now than you had 24 hours ago?
Yes.
How wonderful is that? Like, how enriching is that? I think we've asked questions that still, for all of us, will continue to address, as long as God grants us time to do that. So I wanted to end with a blessing. One of the many blessings in our trove of them is thanks for to God for sharing wisdom with mortal human beings. And in Jewish tradition, there are different blessings for Jewish scholars, for scholars who are not Jewish. We're doing one blessing. Spiritual wisdom and knowledge has been given to us from this richness. So the first part we know.
Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam
Shenatan
Mechof Mato
Levasar
Adam.
Blessed are you, source of the universe.
Blessed are you, source of the universe.
Who has imparted your wisdom.
Who has imparted your wisdom.
To people of flesh and blood.
To people of flesh and blood.
We have been.
Thank you to you all for being an amazing group to study with.
Shabbat shalom.